Wildfires, floods, earthquakes, tornadoes, disasters of nature can move a lot of people from towns and cities temporarily or permanently. And if this happens just before a census count, then what? On Insight, I'll explore this with NPR correspondent Hanzi Lo Wong. The 2020 census is his beat, and now more than ever, this disaster count is a critical question. We're on standby this week for the release of the redacted Mueller report. I'll talk about that with Ken Rudin, the political junkie. And then, a book by Eva Rutland, adapted by her daughter Ginger Rutland, is now in its world premiere as a play at Sacramento Theater Company. It's titled When We Were Colored, A Mother's Story. The actress playing Ginger and the real Ginger Rutland will join me. I'm Beth Ruyak. That's coming up today on Insight. Live from Capital Public Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm Beth Ruyak. Today, as we explore the issues and events that connect people in this region, we have a question prompted by my conversation last week with the mayor of Paradise, California, Jody Jones. Her town had a population of 26,000 people before the campfire last November, and I asked the mayor how many people she thought might be living there this November, 1 year later. She started her answer by considering that there are 1,400 homes still standing.
So I think by November, all of those homes will probably be lived in. That's about 3,000 people at the average household size. And if we're able to get a mobile home park or two up and running by then, you might have somewhere between 3,000 and 4,000 people.
But how do you get an official gauge of this kind of population change? One way is through the 2020 census. But, and this was our question, how do you get an accurate census count in a place where people have been displaced by a natural disaster? And since some local funding formulas are tied to the census count, how does a town or a city preserve its economic position during this transition? NPR's national correspondent Hanzi Lo Wong can help answer those questions. His beat, in fact, is the 2020 census, and he's joining us from station KUT in Austin, Texas. Hi, Hanzi. Glad to have you on the program.
Hi, Beth. Thank you for having me.
So the census counting will actually begin in about a year, in April of 2020, correct?
That exactly is a reference date. It officially starts in rural Alaska in January of 2020, but most households around the country can participate about mid-March, a few weeks before Census Day, April 1st.
Let's say the recovery in Paradise will not have changed that much by then. Where do we begin to answer this question about a disaster count, which in this area is going to apply to a lot of towns hit by wildfires?
You know, this is a very complicated question and certainly is one on a long list of issues the Census Bureau is going to have to resolve before the count officially starts. And traditionally, the Census Bureau does have lots of different methods in making sure that they count every person living in the country as the Constitution requires every 10 years. And that obviously includes people living in areas affected by natural disasters like wildfires. Unfortunately, we don't know exactly what the Census Bureau is going to do just yet. They don't finalize those plans probably until closer to the start of the census. But generally speaking, they do have ways of making sure that areas affected by natural disasters, they send census workers, dedicated census workers, to visit every address they have on file to make sure those addresses have a mailing instructing them how to participate in the census. And in some cases, sometimes the Census Bureau also, in addition to leaving a mailing with instructions or a form, they also do in-person interviews and make sure that people are counted and their information is collected. And that's, you know, one thing to keep in mind is for 2020, for the first time, all households in the U.S. will be able to participate online, which may make it easier for some folks who may be displaced, but they still have access to their phone, smartphone. If they can get on the internet, there will be a website. You can put in your information. You don't have to wait for a paper form to arrive or make the effort to put it in the mail. Or you can also call a 1-800 number for the first time, and that will be available in multiple languages for the first time as well. So multiple options to allow people to make sure they participate.
I want to get back to the ways to respond in just a moment. But in the meantime, there is precedent for dealing with disasters. New Orleans, for example, post-Katrina must be one example. I think the difference now is that natural disasters in this time of climate change are hitting many more towns and cities much more often. And so the need for people on the ground to respond in this way must have really jumped.
Well, you know, what's interesting is that Puerto Rico has already been designated as a place that will receive census workers on the ground visiting every address that the Census Bureau has on file, every household address. And census workers will be leaving mailings and possibly forms and not relying on a mail service, just making sure there's that in-person delivery in order to make sure that Puerto Rico is counted.
So, Hansi, play this out for us in paradise. And I know it's speculative at this point, but how might a count happen there next year?
Well, it's possible, again, that the Census Bureau is going to look at its list of addresses that they have for Paradise. And if it is designated as one of these areas that receives special attention, there will be census workers delivering in person mailings and forms with instructions, possibly paper forms, instructions on how to go online or call a 1-800 number. And if there is no response from that address, the Census Bureau will have to do some detective work and figure out, is this an abandoned home or is this maybe someone is displaced from their home? And the census workers will also they'll be keeping an eye out in these areas that are hit by disasters to see where are the places that people have been displaced, where may they be living temporarily? Are there trailer parks that have popped up or are being populated? And if those areas are found, the Census Bureau may send census workers to interview people in person to make sure that those folks are counted.
I'm talking with NPR national correspondent Hansi Lo Wang. He is at station KUT in Austin, Texas. I find it interesting, Hansi, that this is your beat. When did that happen, and what was the conversation that led up to this in NPR's decision making?
Well, I started covering the 2020 census about 2 years ago, I started covering this in 2017. Something that isn't happening until 2020, but what's really interesting and I think really important to drive home here is a lot of the decisions about the census, about the 2020 census, are made in the years before the census actually starts. How people are counted, who is counted, and what information is collected. Those are decisions that are made in the years leading up to it. And I've been tracking those decisions and trying to understand it and trying to help our listeners and our readers understand it, because this is a constitutional mandate to count every person living in the country. And these numbers, this data affect people's daily lives, believe it or not. It may seem really bureaucratic, it may seem very abstract, but these are numbers that determine how many congressional seats and electoral college votes each state gets. It also determines, as you mentioned earlier, federal funding, how that is distributed around the country. More than $880 billion a year in federal funding for schools, for roads, for other public services. It is distributed partly based on the population counts of your local community. And this census is only done once. There are no do-overs. So whatever data are collected in 2020, that's going to be data that will live with us for the next 10 years. And that's going to be the snapshot. They're going to be the building blocks to build the reality that we're all living under. The policymakers are relying on this to make sure they make sound policy decisions. Also, businesses rely on this to figure out where to build new supermarkets. So this is really fundamental to what our next 10 years is going to look like.
So back to Paradise, if its population at the time is only 3,000 or 4,000 people, that becomes the new population of the town, correct?
That would be the official population if that is what is ultimately counted by the Census Bureau. And, one other thing to keep in mind here is, it's a tricky question. The census counts people where they usually live or sleep. And for folks who do a lot of traveling or maybe are displaced because of natural disasters, that's the question to keep in mind. Where do you put your address? And so for folks who are displaced by natural disasters like a wildfire, that can be a very complicated question. Where are you usually live or sleep? Maybe at the time of the census, you're not quite sure just yet. And so that will have impact on what the official count of places hit by wildfires will be.
One of the controversies over the census has been the proposed citizenship question, and California is among a number of states and cities that are suing the Trump administration. What's the status right now of those lawsuits?
Right now, essentially, we're waiting for the Supreme Court. The lawsuits, there were two lawsuits in California that a federal judge, U.S. District Judge Richard Seaborg in San Francisco, he made a ruling recently and he blocked a citizenship question, plans for the citizenship question. And this is a question that asks, is this person a citizen of the United States? The Trump administration says it wants that question on the census, and essentially that means that every person, it would be asked of every person in every household in the country. The Trump administration says it wants that question in order to use those responses to better enforce part of the Voting Rights Act. And this is a part of the Voting Rights Act that protects against discrimination of racial and language minorities to make sure their vote essentially is not, their voting power is not diluted within voting districts. This is a way to use those responses in order to figure that out. And just U.S. District Judge Richard Seaborg in San Francisco, as well as federal judges in New York and Maryland, as part of the other lawsuits, they have all ruled that adding this question violates administrative law, is a misuse of the Commerce Department, the head of the Commerce Department, Commerce Secretary Wilbur Ross, who oversees the census. It's a misuse of his authority over the census because they're it is unclear what exactly is the purpose of this question. The judges have ruled that this is, they believe this is not about the Voting Rights Act, and that collecting information through a citizenship question will not better enforce the Voting Rights Act, which already does rely on existing citizenship estimates collected by the Census Bureau. Now, if you talk to voting rights experts, they say there's no data problem here. And so right now we're waiting for the Supreme Court to rule on an early ruling by in the New York cases, because all of these rulings have been appealed at the circuit court level. Some of them have been appealed now to the Supreme Court. And ultimately, we're waiting to see what the Supreme Court is likely to rule by June. I'll be at the Supreme Court on April 23rd, where there'll be oral arguments over this issue. And this is the Census Bureau is waiting, and essentially the printers that they have lined up to print all the forms, they're waiting to figure out which version of the census paper form to print, one with the citizenship question or one without one. And they have to start printing, the Census Bureau says, by July 1st. So this is going to be a very tight deadline.
So these cases wouldn't stall the census. It just affects, or I guess anything is possible, but at this point, it's only affecting the printing, correct?
No, this could stall the census if there is no decision by July 1st when the Census Bureau says these paper forms have to be printed. That not only affects the paper forms, but a string of actions that have to be taken. There is a very important to-do list that the Census Bureau has to do, and they're all interconnected. And so not meeting that deadline could affect other things down the line and could risk other preparations for the 2020 census, which again has to officially start in rural Alaska in January of 2020. So we have less than a year. And this is going to be a big issue as well, because census advocates, the Census Bureau is trying to get ready to talk about the census more to the greater public, to encourage people to participate in the census. And these lawsuits have been filed because California, as well as other states and cities and other groups, are very concerned that this question asking about citizenship status in this current political climate of increased immigration enforcement and anti-growing, anti-immigrant rhetoric, a lot of folks are concerned that this question, if it is on the census, will discourage many households with non-citizens that may also include citizens from participating in the census, and that could risk the accuracy of the census data collected.
What happens if someone doesn't complete a census form? Is there follow-up in any way?
If you leave any of the questions incomplete on a census form, you submit that, it's possible that you may get a follow-up phone call, you may get a follow-up in-person visit from a census worker to try to fill out that information. That's possible. And according to federal law, everyone is required, every household is required to answer every question on the census. And if you do not, you could be subject to a fine.
So back to what you were mentioning about how people will be contacted. The census form might come in the mail. It can be completed online. There is an 800 number that's in English and Spanish where people can respond. As well as other languages. Are there concerns about information being protected with these various ways of filling out the questions?
Yes, that this is going to be the first census that every household can participate online. That brings cybersecurity risks. And this is also a major concern at the Census Bureau. And the Census Bureau has already reached out to Department of Homeland Security as well as federal intelligence agencies to try to be proactive and address these issues. The Census Bureau has also reached out to social media companies like Facebook and Google and Twitter to try to think how can they address possible disinformation campaigns and possible attempts to really cause confusion and disrupt the census going into not only it's going to be the first census for everyone to participate online, but also it's going to be happening during a very heated presidential race,
right.
2020. Two
right.
things are happening at once, the census and the presidential race.
All right, Hansi, I think we'll stay in touch with you about this, but thanks for filling in a lot of questions that we had and that our listeners had. It was great to have you on Insight.
Thank you for having me.
That is NPR national correspondent Hansi Lo Wang joining us from KUT in Austin, Texas. You can follow all of us at CAP Radio Insight. And tomorrow, Sacramento's Mayor Daryl Steinberg will join us on this program to talk about the teacher strike, the Sac Republic FC Stadium deal, maybe even the new Kings coach. So if you have a question for the mayor, we ask that you leave us a voicemail. The number is 916-234-3279. Again, that's 916-234-3279. You might hear your question and an answer from the mayor on tomorrow's show. You're listening to Insight on CAP Radio. This is Insight Live on Capital Public Radio. I'm Beth Ruyak. Eva Rutland wrote more than 20 romance novels in her lifetime, but in her memoir, which was written in the 1940s and 50s, she traces her family's move from Atlanta to Sacramento. Eva and her husband Bill Rutland, with their four young children, became the first Black family on the block of their neighborhood in Sacramento, and their children became the first Black children in their public school. Bill was a civilian with the Tuskegee Airmen. So Ginger is one of the Rutlands, now all grown up and very successful children. She re-released her mother's book in 2007 with a new title, When We Were Colored, A Mother's Story. And then she adapted it into a play, which is in the midst of its world premiere at Sacramento Theater Company on the Pollock stage. The show continues through April 28th. In the studio with me, it's a pleasure to welcome back Ginger Rutland, the playwright. First time I'm introducing you with that title.
Yes.
Welcome. Glad to have you here.
Thank you.
I also have the actress who plays Ginger, Brooklyn Solomon. Hi, Brooklyn.
Hi.
Glad to have you, too. So, Ginger, you place us in the play in the present tense with your family, but their questions and experiences from decades ago can, in an interesting way, become our questions. How did you do that? How did you work on the voice for the audience?
I have, when I published the book in 2007, my mother and I went on tours throughout Northern California, also around the country. We were in New York, we were in Atlanta, we were in Florida, and I told the story, her story, during those periods, and it became the audience reaction was very inspiring to me. Both white people and Black people sort of gravitated toward us, and we were sort of like a safe place where they could talk about things that happened to them in their own lives regarding race. White people who said, you know, when I was a little girl, I had this Black friend, and my mother wouldn't let me play with her. And then the Black people saying, oh, I remember going to school and being the only Black child in that classroom and how awkward it was for me and how ostracized I felt. So I felt the story had universal appeal and for both today and way back when.
Hmm. You wanted this to be a happy, upbeat story. There's a note in the program that you wrote, this is not just another play about Black grievance. It is also about the joy of being Black, of two people falling in love, laughing, dancing, raising children, and growing old and infirm together. Had you seen too much of the unhappy story?
I had. I tell you, I go to Ashland a lot, where they have this wonderful regional theater. They do a lot of Black plays, and they're all uniformly grim. And I told those people in Ashland, I said, hey, I've been Black all my life. And believe me, life is not that grim for me. There's a lot of joy in being Black, and I don't think that's emphasized enough. And when my mother wrote her book, she wrote about the Black middle class, actually the Black upper middle class. And there's yes, there was discrimination. Yes, some bad things happened. But for the most part, she had a happy life. I've had a happy life. And I think that part of the Black story isn't told often enough.
Except the word to her wasn't Black, was it?
No, she called it colored. That's why when we were colored, that's why I changed the title of her book. It was originally entitled The Trouble with Being a Mama, which I thought was boring. So I changed it to When We Were Colored, which was the polite phrase of her day.
So your mom passed in 2012, but before then, she had been on Insight with the previous host, Jeffrey Callison. And that matter of retitling the book is talked about. It's addressed in the play, by the way, in a very funny scene. But we thought it would be a pleasure for everybody to hear your mom on this program. First, you're going to hear the voice of the host, Jeffrey Callison.
This was your first book, but it had a different title when it came, when you first wrote it. What was the title then?
The Trouble with Being a Mama, which is the title I like. But my ginger, she liked being colored, so that's why we changed it.
She is amazing, adorable, and precious in this play. What I love is that the characters on stage give a dimension and freshness to the story that I think is so palpable in 2019, Ginger. It's quite an experience.
Yeah, it is an experience for me. As I said in my note, this for me was a love letter to my parents, right? And when I see it on stage, I just, when you're a kid growing up, your parents are just your parents, and you don't think they're extraordinary in any way. But the more I write about my mother and think about her and my father, they were extraordinarily good parents, and they lived, you know, interesting, good lives.
Brooklyn, tell me about the relevance this play has for you.
It definitely resonates. From the time that I first read it, I fell in love with the play. I fell in love with the characters. Certain aspects of the interactions between Ginger and her mother, you know, remind me of interactions between myself and my mother. And it's so relevant. It really is.
When you walk on stage, I think a lot of the audience that knows Ginger must gasp and think, oh, what great casting. You have every mannerism, the way you dress, you got it right. But how was it to try to capture this person who's quite well known throughout the region? And there's a bit of an expectation in taking on this role.
It's definitely nerve-wracking when I know that people that know her are in the audience, of course, but just having been around her for as long as I have, from a couple of years ago to now, I feel comfortable with her, so it makes it much easier.
There's a scene about the afro, and the two of you can probably tell this story together. But the play overall pulls out vignettes that take on what I'll call topics, maybe signature topics that both Black and white people talk about. And one of the maybe lighter ones is the afro. That's a true story that happened?
That was a true story. I mean, when I was going to college in the 60s, I originally arrived like all the other Black women with straightened hair. And we got there and we were in the Black is Beautiful and Black Power movement. And I cut all my hair off and I got this huge, enormous afro, which dismayed my father no end. And Brooklyn plays that role really well.
And you play the scene with your dad saying you're wearing that fork in your hair, the pick in your hair.
Yes.
And so talking about that, that happens to be, is that really how you wear your hair too?
Yes. I cut my hair off like 3 years ago.
Is there ever any discussion about the way you wear your hair now?
Yeah. I mean, now it's mostly positive. I'm primarily positive. I'm just in a store or at a restaurant and someone will just come up to me and they're like, I love your hair.
Yeah.
Like it's kind of the thing now, natural hair. It's, you know, going back to being natural.
Yeah. It was controversial in the 60s, mm-hmm. and it was exaggerated in the 60s. Mm-hmm. Like, my afro was hard to get through a door. It was so big, you know. It was kind of ridiculous. I've toned it down a bit. But,
of course.
But in those days, that's what we were trying to express, a new, you know, a comfort with not just our color, black, which was also an insult, mm-hmm. you know, way back when, but also our natural hair, our broad noses, our thick lips, everything about us, we wanted to say, let's not be ashamed of it anymore. Let's be proud of it.
In one of what for me was the most poignant scenes, you as a little girl are talking to your mom about friends at school. And you're sitting on her lap and you say, who can't I play with?
This actually, I take everything that happens to a bunch of different people in my mother's book and they all happen to me, Ginger. This incident actually happened to my older sister, Elsie. Elsie had a little white friend at school and she would only play with her at school because her mother, the white girl's mother, did not want her daughter to play with colored people because colored people were dirty, colored people were uncouth, colored people were da-da-da-da. And so Elsie comes home and she's invited the little girl to come to her house. And she doesn't come. And she's really crying and she's very sad. And she says, you know, the white girl's mother, you know, her mother's very careful with her. She can't play with Chinese and she can't play with colored. And I wish I wasn't colored. And then she says to her mother, Mom, who can't I play with? And the mother's a little confused. What do you mean? You can play with anybody. She says, mm-hmm. Well, aren't I special too? Isn't there somebody I can't play with? Like, maybe I can't play with really black people who are really, really dark. And the mother says, are you nuts? No. And she says, well, aren't there maybe some Indians who don't speak English that I couldn't play with? And it's really sad. And I think my mother was, when she wrote that, she was thinking about, anytime you get a child who's rejected, you as a parent, you can't fix that. You know, what happens to the child outside in a school when other children are mean to them or they experience hurt and you want to protect them from the hurt, but you can't. And I think this was a vivid description of children hurting children and parents being or mothers being unable to protect them from that hurt.
Mm-hmm. It is also an example of how I think you raise questions that are present, that mm-hmm. are today, because I can imagine that conversation happening in homes, sadly, still, who can't I play with?
Yes.
Mm. You are listening to Ginger Rutland, and in the studio also is the actress Brooklyn Solomon, who plays Ginger Rutland in the play When We Were Colored. It is in its world premiere at Sacramento Theater Company through April 28th. You might know that Ginger was in her career in television news. She was for a long time at the Sacramento Bee on its editorial board. At one point, she was a commentator here at Capital Public Radio for a number of years. And you worked with an important director, I think, for this body of work. And the directing in the play is really remarkable, along with the character development. Do you want to talk about working with him?
Yeah, his name is Stephen Eich. And Stephen Eich, it was a serendipitous way in which he got the play. My sister had a friend who knew him, and we sent the play to him. He called me and said, hey, I love this. I really want to do it. And over a period of many months, he and I rewrote the play together, and then he came and directed it. And I think he did a great job. The Pollock Theater is this small space, and
when you sit in the seats, you're really kind of in the stage, on the stage. You're at the edge of it. It's a very long and narrow, intimate theater.
Very intimate. And he did a kind of a minimalist Brooklyn can talk more about the minimalist kind of. He made it simple for you.
It was very simple. He did an amazing job directing, because the transitions are so seamless. Because some of them are, you know, even happening while other action is happening on stage, but you don't notice it. Working with him was a dream.
I tweeted a picture of the stage at Cap Radio Ruyak when I saw the show over the weekend. You can't tell that the edge of it is all of us sitting right there. I do want to add a bit of a parental guidance, which I think is appropriate for the play, don't you?
Yeah, sure.
Middle school and up, but probably not under middle school.
Right. I think so. I don't think people in elementary school would understand
it. They wouldn't really even,
There are some really funny scenes with your dad, and the actor who plays your dad takes him on beautifully. We should say something about him, Michael Asbury.
Yeah, he's terrific. He really, when I saw, when he auditioned, he actually sent in a video, and I saw it, and I said, oops, that's Dad. He's really, he really embodies my father in a way that I was so happy to see.
Your dad navigates these issues about housing. Where and how can the family get a house in a good neighborhood and jobs? When is he accompanied and treated in different ways and even served in in different places? The N-word is addressed in a scene with your dad. Was there some debate about...
There were, Mom, it's exactly as it's discussed in the play. My father used the N-word liberally, as many black people do in their own homes with among themselves. And my mother, when she wrote the book in the 40s and 50s, used it as well. And when we republished it in 2007, there was a lot of discussion about should we continue to use the word. And my mother said, we will continue to use it. And so now I just say anybody who's offended, they have to take it up with my mother, who is dead, or my father, who is also dead, and otherwise. But it's an authentic, I think, expression of what black family life was like and is still like, I think, often.
We're invited into the debate, though.
Yes.
Right there in the play. I think, if this is correct, your dad was at one point the highest ranking black civilian employee at McClellan Air Force Base.
Yeah, he was. He was actually the highest ranking civilian employee there. Black, white, green, blue. He was. He began his career at Tuskegee Army Air Base during the Second World War. And Tuskegee was where they trained black pilots for the first time. And then when Truman integrated the armed forces and integrated civil service, he moved first to Ohio, where my twin sister and my brother and I were born. And then we came to Sacramento in 1952. And he gradually moved up the ranks at McClellan and retired as the top assistant to the general there, Dewey Lowe at the time.
I'm sorry, we still stumble. I still stumble in these conversations sometimes, distinguishing him as a black civilian employee, which is the way I found it written in a historical accounting.
Yeah.
And then sometimes that's not even necessary, just the highest ranking civilian.
Yes, and there. He did, you know, United States Air Force provided him a nice, comfortable living.
Ginger, the play... is probably embarrassing or painful for people because of how it reveals everybody has acted at times in the past and people have been treated or mistreated in the past. There is definitely that reality. You serve it to us with a lot of humor and, my gosh, so much love. But the reality is still the reality.
Well, I don't want people to leave feeling guilty. I just want them to leave feeling informed, and I hope more knowledgeable just about black life, how the extent to which, as my mother always said, you know, people are people, and they're very much alike, and black families are like white families or Asian families or Hispanic. We're very much the same in the way we feel about each other and our children and what we aspire to and so on.
Let's hear a bit from Brooklyn as Ginger. I think you're going to share some of a monologue with us. Do you want to set this up a little?
Yeah, this is from the top of Act Two, the conversation with the parents about the Afro and the militant behavior in college and whatnot, and just in addressing the term black, you know, versus colored or Negro, and just explaining to your father that, hey, you know, we're trying to change how people see us and how we see ourselves.
So from When We Were Colored, this is Brooklyn Solomon as Ginger Rutland.
We're trying to change the paradigm, Dad. Make ourselves proud of what we once were ashamed of, starting with our color, our blackness. Our African-American studies professor actually had us look up the words black and white in the dictionary. Under white, it says morally pure, innocent, clean. Under black, it says harmful, evil, or wicked. Even other black people hate black people. You know that old ditty. If you're white, you're all right. If you're yellow, you're an okay fellow. If you're brown, stick around. But if you're black, stay way, way back. It's about pride, Dad. Pride in the color of our skin, pride in our full lips, and yes, pride in the texture of our hair. I'm not going to spend the rest of my life trying to look like a white woman.
That's Brooklyn Solomon. She earned her degree in theater from Sac State, and in Celebration Arts production of Bourbon at the Border, she earned a Sacramento Emmy nomination for her role as Mae Thompson. It's fun to watch Ginger watch you as Ginger. Have you had to hold yourself back at times, Ginger?
No, I am so thrilled that Brooklyn is playing me. I wish I could be as beautiful and as young and as vibrant as she is, you know, but I'm a little old. But anyway, I am so grateful that she took this role on. And I think she does a fabulous job of it.
All right, just two more quick questions. Is this play being heard and seen differently in the Sacramento region in light of the Stephon Clark case, in this era that we were in? In fact, I think you were working on the play during the time of this case. So is there a connection in any way for you?
I think there's a connection in the fact that bad things happen to black people. But that's not the only thing that happens to black people. Good things happen to them as well. Life goes on. Yes, there's discrimination. Yes, there's mistreatment. But there is the drumbeat of life, both the happy drumbeat and the sad drumbeat, keep on coming. And I think if there's anything I want people to know is that so much of the black narrative is the Clark stories or the Trayvon Martin stories or the bad things that happen. And you seldom see just life that goes forward for black people that's also, you know, loving and they, you know, people fall in love and they dance and they have a good time and they love their children. Those kinds of things are seldom part of the black narrative and they don't make the media. They don't make TV news. They just don't. And they're out, but they're out there. And that's the way most of us live our lives.
True. I would agree with that. Definitely. You don't see the positive out there as much. And good things do happen to us.
Or the joy.
Yes, there's a lot of joy. There's a lot of joy.
So to wrap this up, is there any expectation then that people should or shouldn't come to this play with?
I think when people see the word When We Were Colored, they think it's going to be another grim example of black life. It's not grim. It's funny. It's happy. It's uplifting. And I think you should come with an idea of having a good time and leaving happy.
Definitely. You're going to have a great time.
And the little girl in the play, our young little Abisola Forrester,
yes,
is absolutely a doll. And I do want to mention that Natalie Autumn Bennett, mm-hmm, who plays your mom.
Yes, she's great. And she looks like mom. That's the other. My mother was
she
quite.
She looks exact. It's Uncanny.
Yes.
And the role of the little girl is shared by Lauren Taylor Piazza as
yes.
well. So now we've mentioned almost the whole cast, Elizabeth Ann Springett and Stephen Ross Thomas. So really terrific. Congratulations. I know this has been a community project of love. So to everyone that has been a part of it, I know there's great joy in seeing it get to the stage.
Yes.
Thank you so much, Ginger.
Thank you.
Glad to have you here. Ginger Rutland, and thanks to you, Brooklyn. Brooklyn Solomon as Ginger Rutland in When We Were Colored at Sacramento Theater Company on the Pollock Stage. It's through April 29th, sorry, 28th. There's a lot on our website. Jeff Hudson's review of the play, the past conversations, including more of Jeffrey's segment with Eva and Ginger, and you can get ticket information on the Pollock Stage through April 28th. This is Insight at capradio.org/insight. You're listening to Insight live on Cap Radio. I'm Beth Ruyak. NPR is reporting, as you might have heard, that the full redacted version of the Mueller-Russia investigation report is expected to be released Thursday. When it is, we will likely be shifting to NPR special coverage. Let's check in today, though, with the political junkie Ken Rudin. We'll explore how the details of that report might ripple across the country to California. Ken, welcome back to Insight.
Thank you, Beth.
So, about the report and the impact on California and states in between, I know there's a lot of speculation, including that something embarrassing might be said about the president. But what's your perspective on the release of the report?
Well, first of all, I mean, we've had a history of things being embarrassing that are being released about the president, and that doesn't seem to affect the body politic at all, let alone his polling ratings. So for all the things we've learned about Donald Trump, the things he said, the self-inflicted wounds, not to mention this 400-page report that's being released on Thursday, what does embarrassing mean anymore? What does it mean to him? What does it mean to his followers? That's another thing completely. But the fact is that since Attorney General William Barr released his 4-page report back in late March
right.
about the Mueller report, which basically said that he was completely absolved of any kind of collusion. There was no proof of obstruction of justice. That gave the president and his supporters the green light to say, well, he's been totally exonerated, totally freed of any kind of legal jeopardy. And I think that's what most of the American people feel at this point.
So just quickly, some of the moves this might set up for key Democrats who happen to also be Californians, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi, Adam Schiff, and the House Intelligence Committee. What could come next?
Well, that's another question completely, because just because the report is out and Donald Trump says, I've already been exonerated, that doesn't mean that the investigation stopped. And you're absolutely right. California plays this huge role, not only with Nancy Pelosi as Speaker of the House, but Adam Schiff, who's the chairman of the House Intelligence Committee. Those investigations continue. There's subpoenas that will be released. There will be investigations. There will be summoning of people to testify, including William Barr. And that's not over. Not to forget either the Southern District in New York that has its own investigations on the Trump and his family and his businesses. So for all the talk about the president and his supporters, led by Kevin McCarthy, led by Devin Nunes, who say that the president has been exonerated. The president will still talk about treason named at the Democrats. But there's no question that the investigations do not end with the release of the Mueller report, or at least the non-redacted parts of the Mueller report on Thursday.
Speaking of Californians, Ken, I want to talk about Stephen Miller. It's a name we haven't said before in our conversations. He is originally from Santa Monica, Southern California. He's now a top Trump policy advisor and one of those power players behind the scenes that should be talked about.
Well, he is very influential. I guess California can take him as a favorite son, but the fact is that he is probably more Trump. He's probably more of a true believer than Donald Trump is. I think he knows the intricacies and the designs and the purposes of immigration policy and how it plays in the body politic far more than Trump does. Trump seems to be more of a knee-jerk, reactive kind of politician, less of an ideologue. Stephen Miller is definitely an ideologue. So when people talk about, you know, all the changes in the let's get rid of Kirstjen Nielsen in Homeland Security, let's get rid of let's not nominate this guy Ron Vitello as the head of ICE because they're soft on immigration. That is led by Stephen Miller, who is behind the scenes, probably one of the most important and powerful members of the administration, especially on domestic policy.
You're listening to Ken Rudin, the political junkie. I want to shift gears here a little bit to the presidential race because Representative Eric Swalwell has jumped in. So this is one more Californian that we're going to be tracking on the way to the new presidency in 2020. What about Eric Swalwell? How much was he on your radar?
Well, he was always on the list of people who were going, like, it's just like John Hickenlooper, the former governor of Colorado, or, you know, somebody like that. Eric Swalwell, yep, he's thinking of running for president. There was a great article in the New York Times the other day. Here's the argument against Swalwell running. He's 38 years old. Nobody ever heard of him. He's accomplished very little in his time in Congress when he was first elected in 2012. Here's the argument for him running. Well, why not? And that's what it really said, because basically, what does anybody have to lose? Because right now you have 18 Democrats, and perhaps a former vice president may join the group later this month, but you have 18 or 19 Democrats running. Obviously, only one will be the nominee, but unless you do something very embarrassing or you don't acquit yourself well, like think of Jeb Bush in 2016, these Democrats can... You know, they'll be on their MSNBCs and CNN and sometimes on Fox News, and they'll have things to say and people will care what they have to say. But Swalwell is basically a rising star. He's, again, 38 years old. The only person, I mean, Pete Buttigieg, the mayor of South Bend, Indiana, is 37. And given the fact that the youngest person ever elected was John F. Kennedy at 43, these would be new records. But look, you know, it's... At first, I'm saying, what is going on here? This is kind of crazy. I mean, how do you have a three-term congressman or a mayor of 100,000 people think you could lead the free world? But all, you know, whenever I think things like that, I'm reminded of the guy who was elected in 2016, who basically was a TV star, you know, and a successful businessman. So there are no more. You know, in other words, you don't have to be Joe Biden and be in the Senate for 400 years before you're elected president. You can, there are different paths to the White House, and everybody's trying it, and we'll see what sticks.
And sometimes the White House in the campaign isn't actually the goal because you and we others think, oh, is this an attempt to get a bigger job, a TV commentator's job, a book tour, name recognition for future runs? There are so many different agendas now.
And that's true. And there are some people, and I would say that President Trump is among those, who enjoys much more campaigning than governing. I mean, he loves the rallies, he loves the attention, he loves the tweeting, but as far as the intricacies of policy, nobody will ever accuse Donald Trump of being that kind of president.
You mentioned rallies, you mentioned Pete Buttigieg, and with that, I have to bring up West Sacramento Mayor Christopher Cabaldon, who at a rally over the weekend helped introduce Pete Buttigieg, and it must have been rainy outside. I saw the video, and the West Sacramento mayor's jacket was all splattered. We have a small clip of it, so let's take a listen.
This is a historic moment that reveals how far a nation has to go, to be sure. But also that America never runs out of surprises.
Amen to that, right?
Well, you know something, I know this is April of 2019, and we can be fascinated before we get concerned or nervous. And right now I'm still fascinated and still smiling. The frown will probably come next year. But here's the thing, we are so excited about Pete Buttigieg. You know, he's 37 years old, the first openly gay candidate ever, Rhodes Scholar, veteran of the Afghanistan War. I mean, he has all these things and everybody's going crazy about him. He's raising a ton of money. He apparently has supported supplanted the previous flavor of the month, which was Beto O'Rourke, who's also raised millions and millions of dollars. And, you know, all he did, not all he did, but he ran for the Senate in Texas and lost to Ted Cruz. And that's his claim to fame. And then you have these women. You have six women running for president. You know, Elizabeth Warren with detailed policy positions and Kamala Harris with an impressive record and others, Kirsten Gillibrand, Tulsi Gabbard, Amy Klobuchar, and nobody's talking about them anymore. So I don't know if it's something about women that we don't like to talk about, or we don't have the capacity to think about more than one candidate at a time. But it's startling to me, and this is not a criticism of Buttigieg, but it's startling to me that we're so overcome with excitement about this guy that nobody ever heard of a month ago. And yet you have these other women who have been running for a while, and you'll have to be hard-pressed to find a newspaper headline about these candidates lately. But things will change. I know that.
Well, West Sacramento's mayor has been a very popular and accomplished mayor. I think it wasn't a surprise to see him somewhere on a national scene. And I think we may be talking about him again in the future. In the meantime, that's it for us today. Ken, thanks so much for joining us on Insight.
Thanks, Beth.
That is Ken Rudin, the political junkie. And by the way, you can listen to Insight anytime by subscribing to our podcast at capradio.org or wherever you listen to your podcasts. And tell a friend about us. Share a little bit of insight with them. That's Insight for today. I'm your host and writer, Beth Ruyak. I'm on Twitter at @CapRadioRuyak. Our senior producer is Helen Barrington. Our producers are Cody Drabble, Bert Johnson, and Kate Gonzalez. Our technical director is Mark Jones. Our engineer today was Antonio Munoz. Insight's executive producer is Joe Barr. Thanks for joining us. We are back with another live show tomorrow.